At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of Interconnected Voices. I'm Charisse, and today we will be exploring the effectiveness of UK government reforms to end the knife crime epidemic.
No, so what they do is they'll come to your door every couple of hours to check that you're still alive. That's basically the extent of it.
These are actually concrete tools that youth are using together to find mediation, to find conflict
How
resolution.
How a young child can turn into a knife-carrying teenager.
And a police officer was about avoiding confrontation.
Almost half the people in prison today in Britain were expelled from school as children.
I feel they've done nothing about it for ages. They've waited for it to get bad and then done something drastic as opposed to doing something gradually and maybe fixing the problem.
Chain reaction in the community of people feeling a lot of bitterness.
She didn't find any correlation anywhere
on the left-hand side.
So let's look at the way the government is
sort of a way out for the power to be, a way out for the wider society.
Then obviously that
even when the person committed,
denying that policing has anything to do with it.
According to the Office of National Statistics, police recorded offences involving knife crime has risen to 44,076 this year, the highest figure recorded since 2011. And this really makes me wonder, what's driving the increase? How are police relations with communities affecting this? Will the new government reforms increase or decrease knife crime? These are the questions I'll be asking on today's episode.
My personal opinion would be, yes, there is a knife crime epidemic.
This is Tyrone. He is a frontline support worker working with children affected by gangs and knife crime.
Whether the knife crime epidemic is how it's being painted in the media, that is a whole different question. And I don't believe that the way that the stats are painted is that it's just all young black men that are just stabbing each other. Whereas if you look at the whole picture, you start to see that knife crime as a whole is not just a young black man's problem. It's a problem nationwide.
I 100% agree. Like, there were 43,516 knife crime offences in the last 12 months. And every year since 2015, it's increased. But something that's really interesting about what you said is this year, there's been more random knife crime attacks, which I think paints an interesting picture, like you said, about how the media portrays it. Because the media portray it that it's just young black men being the perpetrators and the victims. When in fact, when you really look at it, there's also a lot of Caucasian and other ethnicities being the perpetrators also.
100%, that's totally true. In terms of, if you start looking at it, so like in terms of like if you used to go to Tower Hamlets, who are going to be the perpetrators of knife crime there. If you were to go to, say for instance, Newcastle, who are going to be the perpetrators of knife crime there. These are not the typical stereotype of what the public are led to believe are the people that are carrying knives on the streets of England.
And there's a lot of studies that suggest there's a strong link between school inclusion, exclusion and young people being involved in knife crime and gang affiliation. Do you feel that statement rings true?
1,010%. And this is the thing, because I do a lot of sessions for teachers and stuff, and I talk to them about it, because the problem is that a lot of PRUs are not fit for purpose.
PRUs are people referral units, a place where children are sent when they are deemed unable to be in mainstream education.
So you have children who are going to school for short days. So say, for instance, their day will be from like 9:30 till 2 o'clock, not wearing school uniform, able to go there and swear at teachers, able to smoke on the premises or to smoke around the area. Now, for me, the problem that I have with this is because this child is growing up to be an adult, and school to a certain extent is meant to be a part of preparing them for an adult. Now, if you're in them kind of circumstances and that's the educational place that you're going to, what kind of adult are you going to become? Are we setting you up to succeed, or are we setting you up to become somebody who fails in the society that we currently have? And that's the problem that I have with Prues. Now, don't get me wrong, there are a few Prues. They can see that there is a problem, and they have their kids coming in school uniforms. They have their kids sitting 5, 6, 7 GCSEs, because they understand that although these young people have maybe additional needs, or these young people have behavioural problems, yeah, if we don't keep them up with the other young people who are in the mainstream schools, then when it comes to being an adult and entering the rat race to get a career, then these young people are starting 1,000 metres behind all of their peers.
I agree. And in my opinion, the exclusion system is set up to fail children from lower income families. And on average, poorer young people are 4 times more likely to be excluded than middle class individuals and people that have been taken into care. And it is predominantly African, Caribbean children that are put into these PRUs, which, as you said, are for temporary measures. So my understanding of it is you're meant to go in a PRU to help you then go back into mainstream school. But what tends to happen is it's just used as, I guess, like a filter for your whole school education, where you kind of just fall off the grid and you're just in a PRU. Like, there's sometimes there's situations where there's something called illegal exclusion, where parents are encouraged to take their children out of school and advise them to be homeschooled. But in a lot of situations where these children are from lower income families, their parents can't stay home and homeschool them. So they're just left to like roam around, and there's no record of them, which is so scary that the government is not doing anything about that. It's just this kind of unacknowledged thing that it's just like swept under the rug, because it makes the school look better if they don't have those pupils in there.
Yeah, 100%. I think in terms of, they have these league tables, and you've got a child who is being domestically abused at home. They don't know how to communicate this. They're coming into school and they're acting up. They're not doing their schoolwork. Their grades are slipping. What does the school do? Does the school look at trying to get this young person to open up and trying to signpost this young person to maybe counselling or child protection? Or does the school look at, well, this is going to affect our grades, we need to get him out? And that's what we're finding more and more, is that the teachers will rather deal with the behaviour rather than what is the underneath, what is the reason, what is going on, the root cause of why you are behaving like this. And obviously as well, in terms of the high African and Caribbean attendees to Prues, I believe that there is a stereotype of young black men especially being quite aggressive. Now, I believe that it's the stereotype that feeds into young people, young black men, being easily kicked out of school because they're looked at as aggressive quite easily.
I definitely agree with Tyrone's statements on stereotyping. The worst thing about it is even if a child does actually have anger issues, they get sent to a PRU where they're not taught how to manage their anger. Additionally, 1 in 2 students who attend PRUs are recognised for having mental health issues. And it was acknowledged by Ofsted in 2018 that exclusion units do not have the provision or specialist staff to support these individuals. Tyrone's statements on stereotyping also reminded me of the knife crime campaign released in 2018. It predominantly showed teenage black kids in the campaign with the slogan "Stop the Violence." And then there was an advert, which again only included predominantly young black kids. And as a young black woman, that didn't make me feel good. It just made me feel like the whole of the UK government and the police force think that it's only black people who carry a knife and are knife crime perpetrators and victims. I asked Tyrone about his thoughts on the knife crime campaign.
Like, it took away the worth of a lot of black people, like that this is the only thing that young black people are contributing to society is gangs and knife crime. And I think in the mindset of a young person, when you're constantly seeing negative images about yourself, it can make you feel hopeless. It can make you feel like you will be unable to achieve or rise above what you are currently going through right now, or that you won't be able to compete with people of other races when it comes to going into the job market. Like, it can kind of do that to you, because the mindset is that all you lot are is gang members and people that carry knives.
And that's when I first noticed these couple of men. They grabbed me. Excuse me, I'm arresting you for suspicion of pickpocketing from persons unknown.
This is an archive clip of a man discussing his experiences of living in London during the Brixton riots in 1981.
And I'm thinking, me no pickpocket, me a rasta.
Almost every young black man in Brixton had a story to tell about police harassment or brutality.
I remember getting on a bus one time from Brixton, going to Clapham, and they came on the bus and said I was nicking a purse, took me off the bus, couldn't find nothing on me, they just gave me a good kicking and sent me away. You know, what could you do? There's like 5-6 police and just you as a little black kid. They didn't arrest no one, they just beat us up and left us there.
I didn't join the police as a racist, but whilst I was in the police, I became one. We just went out and made a beeline for whosoever we wanted to arrest. So you'd say you'd seen them try 2 or 3 car door handles. You'd seen them sizing someone up at a bus stop, and you'd see them put their hand towards a lady's handbag. People had no chance of proving their innocence. Evidence was planted. That was a common practice. And assaulting people was almost a daily occurrence.
These interactions between black men and the police have continued to occur into the present day.
6 police officers have been injured in London after a protest against police brutality turned violent. 4 people were arrested.
The reason they were so angry was they were demonstrating over the death of a 25-year-old local black man. His name was Federico da Costa. Locally, he was known as Edson. He was a car mechanic. He was pulled over by police when he was in his car earlier this month. And campaigners say he was brutally beaten. Some reports even that he may have died as a result of his neck being broken.
Edson da Costa was a young black man who was pulled over, detained, and brutally attacked by police officers. No police officers were charged. These accounts are so many years apart, but the narrative still remains the same. And it really makes me wonder how many young black men will feel harm and sometimes death at the hands of the London Metropolitan Police, and what it will take for the UK police force to change their biased ways. Given the history between black men and the police force, I am really surprised by the recent knife crime reforms brought in by Boris Johnson, such as the Knife Crime Protection Orders, which is part of the Offensive Weapons Bill. It can be applied to children as young as 12, and the law is based off police officers' suspicions, as opposed to police officers having any evidence an individual is carrying a knife. For example, if a police officer suspects that a young person is carrying a knife, they can go to the court, get a knife crime protection order, and that can stop the individual from going to certain areas, restrict them from using social media, and they'll have a curfew. I personally think this reform is wild, considering that police officers will just be basing their decisions off of how they feel about a person. And as we know from Stop and Search, their intuition isn't always correct, as it seems to be targeted. I spoke to Amani Robinson, writer, researcher and educator, whose goal is to make prison abolition and transformative justice possible.
I think that, you know, from everything we've experienced with black people in relation to the police, trusting the police to make decisions that aren't based on bias and stereotyping, whether that's kind of conscious overt racism or whether it's unconscious or as a result of, you know, some sort of thing that can't really be about the individual police officer, right? So having orders that allow you to search people in a particular area which is, you know, racialized. So like sort of Section 60 stops, which allow you to kind of put a whole area on hold and search sort of anyone regardless of whether they have a particular suspicion on that individual. I think that giving the police greater powers to be able to kind of fall into this trap of discrimination is really a worrying space to be in at the moment for young Black people who are kind of going to be the target of these powers, but also for the general public who are kind of sitting back and letting these changes happen. I think there's a lot of pushback to what Boris Johnson's government is, or Boris Johnson himself is sort of implementing. We kind of lose focus on things that are actually really impacting just sort of poor communities, Black communities, and people who continue to be, to kind of be receiving the brunt of the most egregious laws that we have in this country.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I always think, like, carrying a knife is wrong, but people carry a knife usually because they're scared, because they don't feel protected by the police. So I think that's a really interesting dynamic. Like, the police are obviously targeting certain groups, but maybe if they felt more protected by the police, they wouldn't feel the need to have to carry a knife in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're used to sort of saying, okay, this is wrong and this is right. And actually, if we look at that a little bit further, a little bit more deeply, then we realise that actually these are people making logical decisions to try to protect themselves from what they see as actual harm. It's not paranoia. It's not, you know, bravado. It's people who are really actually trying to protect themselves from the harm that they experience in their everyday lives. It doesn't mean that it's a good strategy or an effective strategy to protecting them themselves from harm. But if we try to understand the ways in which people are making decisions for reasons that are, you know, logical and understandable, then we begin to kind of see a different perspective to this sort of law and order knife, having a knife is always wrong, because actually what we see is people making decisions to, you know, for their own protection. And I think you're absolutely right that from a lot of research that's been done and from people just having conversations about stop and search and also about carrying knives in particular, it is for that logical reason of trying to protect yourself, even if the kind of practice of carrying a knife doesn't actually end up in that person feeling more protected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And you touched on stop and search a little bit, because I know Savid Javid enhanced the Section 60 power, giving police officers more scope to stop and search without reasonable suspicion. Now, you and I both know that stop and search does not work for knife crime. What do you think is the main reason that the government keep enforcing it, like keep pushing it as a tactic, even though there's loads of evidence that show that it just doesn't work?
Sure. So, like, the main kind of rhetoric around stop and search is, and you know, Black communities themselves will say, you know, we want safe communities, we want to be able to feel calm and relaxed and know that the police will find somebody with a knife on them, and that those weapons will be taken off our streets. We want safe communities. We want to feel like we don't have to worry about these things. And yet, every year, statistics come out that show that there is very little impact, if any at all, with stop and search on the prevalence of people carrying knives. And most of the stop and searches that are carried out are for drugs. I think it's usually around 60%. It doesn't fluctuate that much for usually small scale possession. So possession of a small amount of cannabis, for example. And so what you get is, you know, the power for police officers to stop and search people on the street is sort of held up in the name of keeping our streets knife free. But then actually it's not being used for that. If it was being used for that, if it was effective for that, then we'd be in a different place, but we're not. And actually what's happening is most of the time people are stopped on suspicion of being in possession of a small amount of cannabis. And most of the time when searched, they don't find any cannabis. And so there's, I think, you'll have to check this, but I think it's something like a 97% ineffective rate of finding an illegal substance when a stop and search is carried out. And so it really begs the question of, like, you know, why? And this is, I guess, your question: why are we still using this? And I think it's because we're not building our kind of understanding of stop and search, of policing in this country, around evidence. We're building it around fear and this desire for a safe community and this reliance on the idea of policing and surveillance and prisons as really being things that are effective in tackling the root causes of violence, the root causes of harm.
I also think it's got a lot to do with our, like, local policing cultures. Like, the London Met Police are one of the highest users of stop and search. And there's something called extrapolation, where something doesn't work and it hasn't worked for a while, but governments just keep trying and trying to show it works. So even if there's no positive benefits, it's become so much of what people are used to, as in the police force, they can't imagine their working day without it. So I think that's also something to think about. I wonder if it comes a lot from, yes, it's enforced by the government, but something that maybe the police enjoy. And also it looks proactive. Like, as you say, people have this kind of idea that the police can fix everything. So if the police are saying, the government are saying we can increase stop and search, it looks like they're doing something good. When you really look at it and look at the details, it's actually not helping anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we really rely on this idea that if something bad happens, that this kind of carceral logic is useful in tackling those problems. But actually, you know, there was a time before this model, this current model of policing and prisons and surveillance, and there can be something after that. But I think, you know, you're right when you say it's very difficult for people to imagine that. It's very difficult for people to think about and build and create alternatives to kind of punitive responses of harm. And you know, yes, we want to be able to do something when something bad happens or when we experience harm. But the fact is that, you know, we're just talking about stop and search, which is actually totally ineffective at tackling knife crime. And so we have to think about, the things that we are doing, are they working or are they not working? Because if they're not working, then at best they're just reproducing and kind of reinforcing harm on precisely the communities that actually really need support and care and the chance to be able to develop strategies and responses that work for them to reduce the harm in their communities and also to increase the possibilities for healing.
As a society, the police force is very reactive. It's just a quick fix. It's nothing I really think that is long term. And, like, procedural justice theory suggests that the extent to which stop and search is considered unfair could actually cause crime, because that minority demographic just feels so undermined by the police and they don't trust them. They don't have any social interaction or bond that is positive. So they'd rather seek defence for themselves as opposed to getting the police to help.
Most Black people, communities of colour, communities who are underprivileged, who are living in poverty, you know, communities that are targeted by police violence, are really, you know, it's unlikely that they're going to want to imagine, that we are going to want to imagine, a situation where we are trusting the police, where we are feeling safe and comfortable around the police. That's not something that those are two things that seem at odds with each other. It's not because we don't want to live in societies and communities that we feel safe in. It's that we've never seen the police and the state really show up for us in full holistic ways.
One common theme that came up when I was investigating this story was the idea that police officers should represent the community that they're from. For example, here's Penelope Gibbs, the founder of Transform for Justice, a charity that aims to create a fairer justice system in the UK.
It's not just about stop and search. I mean, they need to get more police officers who are from those communities in London. So, for instance, the Somali community, which is significant in Camden, and it has to be said, is involved in being both victims of and probably, you know, doing a lot of the knife crime in Camden. What we need with the Somali community is we need more Somali police. We need more Somali people in the youth offending team. We need more Somali magistrates and judges. You know, it needs to go wider than kind of what activities are done in terms of the police.
I asked both Amani and Tyrone what they thought about this solution.
To be honest, I'm quite pessimistic about those kinds of reforms.
I think that the police force should be more representative of the communities that it's protecting.
The level of trust that might be garnered between, you know, people of similar contexts and backgrounds is just not comparable to the disparity in the level of power. So people who are police officers have power over people who are not police officers. And that doesn't change regardless of the race or the social background or, you know, the kind of person that officer is.
If you feel like somebody understands what you're going through or somebody understands what you're living through, then as a person, you're more willing to listen when they're talking to about solutions or when they're trying to help you, more likely to listen. If you believe that the person who is trying to protect your community doesn't care about your community, who has never experienced what the people of your community have experienced, then it makes it a lot harder to accept them people in.
It's an officer's job as an arm of the state to really always be an ally to the state. So whatever they're being told to do, whatever is within the remit of their power, that is what they're allowed to do, and that is sort of what they will do.
The police should be doing more community engagement. So going out and speaking to people and getting to know people's names in communities, not because you want to build criminal intelligence, but because you want to protect that community. That then gets people to look at you, young people to look at you as a human being. Now, if you're starting to, as a young person, if you're starting to look at a police officer as a human being and somebody that there is there to protect you, then naturally you start to feel positive about police officers. You start to feel that you should approach them and you should tell them things, and maybe even you should become a police officer when you become older.
What happens when you you know, hire more black police officers is that the burden is then on them to sort of transform policing, but actually they don't have the power to transform policing, even if they wanted to, from within the system with the power that they're given as police officers. It's really about kind of totally restructuring our philosophical understanding of harm. But I really think that we have to kind of start in our communities and remain in our communities, and part of our communities is of course people who are incarcerated, people who are currently in prison, because they tend to be again and again forgotten from these conversations, but they are experiencing egregious harm from the state and from law enforcement.
Can we talk a little bit about your journey and like how you found your like process of being incarcerated? Like, just taking it back to the start, how did you manage to get yourself into that situation?
I was like, from the age of 11, I was a gang member. I take responsibility for my actions, so I don't blame anybody. There was a lot of contributing factors, but I don't blame anybody for my actions because they were my choices. And I became a gang member at the age of 11. By the time I was 14, I'd been kicked out of mainstream school and two pupil referral units. And at 15, I got stabbed by a gang member from another gang. And this kind of sparked a rivalry between the two gangs. And it ended up with, on one night, a gang fight broke out and one young man was killed during the gang fight. And at the time, I didn't know what joint enterprise was. So I'm thinking, I'm okay.
Yeah, so would I.
I was thinking, well, it wasn't me that killed him. So I don't have to say anything to the police. And then they tell me about joint enterprise. And then I end up getting a life sentence for it. So at the age of 16, I got a life sentence for murder by joint enterprise. And I got a tariff of 14 years, of which I served 13 because I had a year taken off by the courts for work, charity work that I did whilst incarcerated.
How did you feel in that moment when they said you've got a life sentence?
To be honest, being 16 years of age, yeah, it was very hard for me to deal with. I remember I was sitting there with my yacht worker, my youth offending team worker, and she was trying to talk to me about what I needed to do, and I didn't want to hear it because, as far as I was concerned, like, my life was over in it. I wasn't gonna come home. There wasn't gonna be a chance for me to contribute to society or to have children or any of that stuff that I would get to do as an adult. To me, that was all taken away in that moment, and it was quite upsetting. And at the time, because I wasn't really accepting the responsibilities for my actions, I was kind of angry at the world. I was angry at everybody because I was blaming everybody else for my situation and not actually taking responsibility.
Yeah, but that was obviously a natural reaction. And then when you got into prison, how were the other prisoners towards you? Was you in juvenile prison?
I started in a juvenile prison in Ipswich. It was Warren Hill. So it was, at the time, it was for juveniles. It's now an adult prison. To me, I'd never heard of the prison before. I was told you're going to Warren Hill. It's in Ipswich. And I was driven on the, what, I don't know what people call them. We call them sweat boxes.
What is that? Is that the little box that you see at the, like, it's like attached to a van?
When you see the court videos and you see like the van that comes out and it's got all the blacked out windows, but you sit in the cubicle and you're locked in that cubicle for the whole journey and there's no seatbelt. There's no seatbelt. Yeah, the law only applies sometimes. But there's no seatbelts in them. And I often did wonder if it was a crash, what would happen? Because obviously you'd be in a lot of trouble because there was no seatbelt or anything safe back there to hold you steady. But I was in that bus for 3 hours. I arrived at Ipswich in Warren Hill Prison, and I went through the process of going into prison, getting your prison number, getting your strip search. And then after that, they were told, oh, we're going to hold you down the segregation unit so that we can observe you to make sure you're not suicidal.
And what is that observation like? Do they literally just watch you for like a long period of time?
No, so what they do is they'll come to your door every couple of hours to check that you're still alive. That's basically the extent of it. But at this time, prisons were overcrowded at this time. I don't know if you remember like mid-2000s when the prisons were overcrowded and they were locking out and people had to stay in police stations and stuff. So I was stuck in the segregation unit for a week because there was no cells in the prison because it was that full. So that was my immediate induction into prison. And then I went on to the wing and it was a different environment because for me, the thing I always say to people, and I say to young people that I work with now, there is nothing positive in prison. There is nothing that grows in prison. Rehabilitation in the way that we think of it doesn't exist in prison. Rehabilitation only exists within the person. Now, if you don't find that place where you are able to mature and rehabilitate yourself, prison won't do it for you. It's not designed that way. It's not like the Scandinavian models where that's what their main objective is. The main objective in English prisons is to punish rather than rehabilitate. So they punish first and then they think about rehabilitation second, which means that you have a lot of people who have come out who have been punished but not rehabilitated. Me being a person who has served a lengthy prison sentence, I can understand the need for prison. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody needs to be incarcerated, but I do believe that sometimes in the interest of the public, that there are people that do need to be incarcerated. But the problem is that we know in this country they're going to be released. So it's about what happens once they are incarcerated. Are we educating them? Are we upskilling them so that they can come out and take part in society? Or are we putting them in prisons that are overcrowded? And at the moment, we're putting them in prisons that are overcrowded. Now, if you're serving a short sentence in there, you're not going to be doing anything. You're going to be locked up for probably 23 hours a day or 23 and a half hours a day because you're only going to get half an hour exercise or maybe an hour association, maybe 2 to 3 times a week. This is what is actually going on inside the prisons inside of Britain. You've got staff coming to your cell. They're giving you your food. They're locking you back behind your door. If you're all going out for open air, you're in a cage and it's very small. That's the difference. If you are going into the normal prison regime of a local prison, the prisons are so full. So say, for instance, we have HMP Bullingdon, which is in Oxfordshire. Their maximum capacity was something like 1,100 and they were holding 1,300. Their regime cannot cope with that. They do not have enough staff to unlock everybody because they have to have the correct ratio of staff to prisoners for obvious reasons, for personal safety. But then in that time that you're in there, you're going to be networking. So it's going to give you a chance to start meeting up with other people who are doing maybe similar crimes to yourself, or maybe you're meeting up with your enemies in this period of time. There is nothing positive being created during a short sentence. Now, the government know this because at times they've said we are going to scrap short sentences because they realize that if you give somebody less than a year, that doesn't give them time to settle and educate themselves, because what course are you going to do within 5 months of being in prison? You're not going to be able to do a course. And that is more the problem, rather than saying he just wants to lock people up. What are you going to do with them? How are you going to turn them into people who are going to contribute to society and want to be a part of society? How are we going to make them feel like they are part of society?
Hearing about Tyrone's experiences made me eager to talk to Amani about prison abolition, as this is what she campaigns for. Prison abolition is the idea that we should entirely remove the prison system from society and instead replace it with rehabilitative techniques. I asked Amani whether prison abolition could be an effective way to reduce knife crime.
A lot of the time when people first begin researching or thinking about abolition, you know, the questions that come up are, okay, so I understand about the non-violent crimes, the petty crimes. I understand about the people who are, you know, not a risk to themselves or others. I get that. But what about the really bad people? They don't say this, but what about the people who I'm scared of? The prison industrial complex teaches us to be afraid of things we don't understand and we don't know. We're taught to be afraid of criminals, but there's no such thing as a criminal. There is such thing as harm. There is such thing as violence. But this idea of this sort of label of a criminal, where you know, once a criminal, always a criminal, is really an abstraction from real life. The prison industrial complex, prisons, policing and surveillance are not actually effective against tackling the root causes of, loss of life through murder, nor is it effective in tackling sexual violence or physical violence.
I'm really like the idea of this concept, and I was reading up about like some of the tools that are used, because Chicago have been doing a few things.
Restorative justice and transformative justice are both approaches that are not based in punishment, banishment, alienation. They're efforts to approach, you know, issues of conflict, mistreatment, abuse, violence.
Talking about the juvenile justice system and shutting those systems of oppression down and in their place for creating restorative rehabilitation, re-entry centers within communities and things like that.
These are actually concrete tools that youth are using together to find mediation, to find conflict resolution. And I think we do a disservice by not bringing these things into our schools.
There's basically several elements that are like go to the integrity of what the peace circle is. One is the use of a talking piece, something that has an importance to the keeper or the people who are in the circle. The keeper is a person who facilitates the circle. So whoever has a talking piece gets to speak, and whoever doesn't gets to listen.
It's a great tool for anyone that holds court with
with young people are in the community. You have teachers that are circle keepers, police officers, parents. You have all kinds of folks that can use the circle process if they're dealing with bringing people together or repairing any kind of harm.
Oh, young people are expelled from school and, you know, people think it's just, well, they don't get along. And then when you have circles where two young women can talk about the reasons why, and then they realize that they have so much in common and that actually incidents like that can bring them together. I don't know how many times I've seen people who fight and then have a circle actually be friends afterwards. I see youth turning to me and saying, you know what, I have an issue with this person, can we have a circle?
That was a clip of staff at Project NIA, a charity in Chicago who advocate for reducing the reliance on incarceration, detention and arrest for young people. Instead, they replace them with prison abolition methods. I think that approach could be really actually beneficial to stop people kind of getting involved in knife crime. So as a preventative measure, I really think it would be great. I'm still trying to understand how it would be beneficial after someone has committed the crime. But like how, not to control them, but how do you help them to heal in a way that is not dangerous to others? So like under that approach, like how would you ensure that they're not hurting other members of the community? Because there's quite a lot of just trust, isn't it, involved in this technique?
Well, yes. So first of all, there are lots of different ways that sort of transformative justice can be implemented. There are ways that it works, and there are ways and times that it doesn't work so well. And the reason is because this is a kind of practice that is in progress, that is always developing, that is based on people seeking a new way of responding to harm. And so this is really also about transforming the culture that we are embedded within, and developing new ways that will be tried and be tested and develop and flourish into something that becomes workable. Our response to harm has to be something that is more effective than isolating people in conditions of actually quite egregious harm and violence. It's interesting because sometimes we say, well, this person did harm, so how can we make sure that they don't do harm to anybody else? And at the moment, in this current logic, our only kind of answer to that is, okay, well, we should do harm to them, right? And so you see how that logic kind of is cyclical and doesn't necessarily make sense, because actually it's ineffective, but we feel like we're doing something.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of like becoming a collectivist society. I feel like that is what the approach kind of encourages. And you know, your community kind of, they have a part in helping you get towards the end of the rehabilitation process. So the community is really
Absolutely.
Engaging in, okay, this is what's happened, so what can we do to fix it? And then within that, see, when I look at it like that, that's when I really see, wow, the benefits this could have to prevent things like knife crime, like to prevent those young boys mm-hmm. falling through the cracks. The rate for reoffending knife crime users is actually half of them reoffend within 6 months, which is insane. But mm-hmm. I guess if there was a lot more going on in the communities, they could potentially see that happening and see the issues arising, and it could prevent it.
Yeah, I think there's two things to be careful of here, though. So first of all, particularly poor working class communities in this country, racialized communities in this country, do a lot to build community, to be in communication together, to live communally, to support each other. And there's a danger of, particularly when talking about knife crime, there's a danger of saying, you know, oh, it's the community's fault. And I know that's not what we're saying, but in kind of public media rhetoric, that's a lot of the time, you know, they see mostly racialized working class poor people And then they call it, you know, black on black crime. And they use these phrases and these kinds of stereotypes and myths about our communities to feed us basically lies that are very far removed from what it's like to live in a black community, to live in a working class community. What we're talking about is not necessarily like how we can improve poor communities, which is what it gets turned into, but actually, you know, how we can provide ourselves and our communities with more than what the state is willing to give us. The other thing I would say is that I'm trying to think about, what does it mean that there are definitely murderers and rapists and people who have committed these crimes or people who have done this harm, who are living in their everyday life, who do not want to be held accountable, nor are they being held accountable by the prison industrial complex. And then you begin to think, okay, so it's not working for people who are in jail, who are serving time for their crimes or their offences, but neither is it working for our general experience of harm outside of a prison context. So you have people who commit harm all the time, who are empowered to commit harm, for example, MPs, prime ministers, people who legislate really harmful policies, who are sort of directly responsible for the deaths and the pain and the violence of lots of people in this country and internationally, right? Abolition is not an alternative to the prison industrial complex, in the sense that, you know, instead of sending you to jail, we're going to force you to do this sort of transformative justice workshop, or we're going to force you into this accountability process, because that won't work either. People actually have to want to transform their behavior, have to want to be answerable for their actions, have to want to develop the kinds of communities and the kinds of relationships. Without those things, then nothing is actually going to work. And so it's also about developing the kind of awareness of yourself and your behavior and your potential for doing harm. That awareness of yourself and your desire to be responsible for that awareness is actually what abolition is about, because you can't force somebody to apologize and be responsible for the harm that they have done. People have to genuinely want to be accountable.
I also do think that if you feel like your community is not judging you and you feel like the community is supporting you, I do think that would perhaps increase the person's intuition to maybe want to change to be part of that community.
I think a lot of people who harm others or who have a kind of history of harming others and harming themselves were also harmed by, you know, their experiences by people around them, and that's a really useful and also you know, sad piece of knowledge, that, you know, people who are hurt other people. And what do you do in that context? Our current system decides to hurt them again. And so there's a kind of, if you step back for a moment and realize that people don't actually want to be in situations of violence. We also have to name the ways that we experience violence in our everyday life, because we think about stabbing as violence, but we don't think about necessarily school exclusions, the disparity of stop and search, our limited access to healthcare, our limited access to leisure and to kind of recreational time, our limited access to capital, our limited access to kind of safe homes and homes that aren't going to kind of fall around you. I really think, you know, within this current context, somehow we've labeled the things that the state tell you are wrong as wrong, and as bad and as the harms and as the violences, and the things that actually cause us harm and pain, we forget to name, or we don't name them in the same light as, you know, this is a violence that I've experienced.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 3 of Interconnected Voices. A huge thank you to my amazing guests, Tyrone and Amani, for contributing to this episode. If you want to get an insight into future shows, please follow @interconnected_voices on Instagram and @interconnectedv on Twitter. I've been Charisse on Interconnected Voices. Transmission Roundhouse. Cloud 3.